Schon wieder Bewerberflaute? Sie schalten Anzeige um Anzeige. Das nervt und ist doch viel zu teuer. Stopp! Raus aus der Recruiting-Spirale. Mit StepStone All Jobs bekommen Sie alle Anzeigen für ein Jahr in einem Paket zu einem fixen Preis. So sparen Sie bis zu 75% Kosten pro Bewerbung und sind jederzeit flexibel. Jetzt Termin vereinbaren auf stepstone.de/alljobs. StepStone. Einfach die richtigen Talente finden für alle Jobs.
And now, Veep Thoughts by Kamala Harris.
We're going to have days, and sometimes there will be days of immense water, of rain, of storms, of flooding. And at the same time, we are a state that has experienced for generations drought. And we must therefore understand that the issues that are present in the climate crisis are varied, and it requires us to be present and to be in front of each of the iterations and variations that include extreme weather that produces a lot of water and extreme weather that produces drought.
This has been Veep Thoughts by Kamala Harris.
Stu Does America.
Kamala? Nah. Mala. Get your Kamala Namala t-shirts, mugs. StuDoesMerch.com. Use the code Stu10. Get 10% off your entire order. YouTube.com/StuDoesAmerica. We went live, by the way, after this interview that we're about to talk about last night. We've been doing this often. Check it out. We have a good question and answer period there as well. So join us. YouTube.com/StuDoesAmerica. Follow the show. We're almost to 100,000, so go there and follow now. Click the bell for notifications, and I don't know, do all the things. Ryan T. Anderson is here for a look at the after Dobbs period for pro-lifers. There's a LeBron James connection to Diddy that I just can't wait to tell you about. But we're going to start by doing Kamala versus MSNBC. It wasn't really a battle, I would say, but there was an interview on MSNBC, a solo interview with a national correspondent-ish. So that's something. The whole thing started with Chris Hayes bragging about how they had the first solo interview with Kamala Harris. And I thought to myself, is that something to brag about? Is that something to brag about? First of all, she's avoiding anyone asking tough questions, so there's a reason she came to you. But secondly, she's been the candidate for multiple months. The fact that she's doing her first solo interview is kind of a thing, and I had so much to say about this. These are all, I have these little cards that I always hold up, and each one of them has a little element. These are all the things I threw out of today, because we have so much to go through. So let's attempt to get through it. Three takeaways from Kamala Harris's interview on MSNBC. This is from the New York Times. And honestly, the three takeaways I kind of agree with. Number one, she avoided a looming scenario. What if Democrats lose the Senate? We'll get into how she was avoiding answers there. Number two, Harris had a roundabout answer, or had roundabout answers to open-ended questions. In other words, she didn't say anything. And a hard-hitting Harris interview is still yet to come. Yeah! Very true. And the fact that the New York Times is even noticing it, maybe there's a little hope out there. We complained yesterday about this constantly. Maybe something's turning around. We will see. Let's go through some of these answers. Here's one of the ones that made maybe the most rounds on the internet. If you happen to be following the aftermath of this interview, Kamala kind of just looking confused as to what she will do on taxes. Watch.
Expanding that child tax credit, or you mentioned housing before, giving that extra money for a first home. If you can't raise corporate taxes, or if GOP takes control of the Senate, where do you get the money to do that? Do you still go forward with those plans and borrow?
Well, but we're going to have to raise corporate taxes, and we're going to have to make sure that the biggest corporations and billionaires pay their fair share. That's just it. It's about paying their fair share. Oh. I am not mad at anyone for achieving success.
Well, yeah, you are.
But everyone should pay their fair share. And it is not right that the teachers and the firefighters that I meet every day across our country are paying a higher tax than the richest people in our country.
No fact check there. It's obviously not even remotely close to accurate. And that's not how our system works. Another way our system doesn't work is when you want to do something and you can't get it through the Senate, you just do it anyway. Now, people are saying, oh, my gosh, she's a joke. I mean, she doesn't know what she's doing. She has no backup plan. She just said, well, we're just going to do it. I think you're missing the point there. The point is she just came out of the Biden administration. She's part of Biden-Harris. They just do things when they want to do them. They don't care what happens in the Senate or the courts or anything else. They just do it. That's what they do. Her plan is to just do it. She's telling you in advance. Unfreaking believable. Now, Stephanie Ruhle, who, look, is telegenic. She's expressive on camera. I can see why she's on television, okay? But she literally massacred journalism last night. It was as if Terrifier 3 came out and she just cut it all the body of journalism into little pieces and threw it all over the front lawn. Like it was a revolting murder, a bloody, disgusting murder of journalism by Stephanie Ruhle last night. I mean, just listen to the setup to this particular question. This one's important. This is, and by the way, a complete lie that she did not fact check. But here it is talking about the economy that she, Kamala Harris, inherited and what she's going to do in the future. Listen to the first line of this.
Over the last 4 years, there have been tremendous economic wins.
What?
And you've just laid out a big plan.
What?
But still, polling shows that most likely voters still think Donald Trump is better to handle the economy.
Listen to her disgusted tone.
Well, here's what I know in terms of the facts. Donald Trump left us with the worst economy since the Great Depression when you look at, for example, the employment numbers.
It was during COVID, and employment was so high because we shut down the government, we shut down the country.
Even before the pandemic, lost manufacturing jobs by most people's estimates, at least 200,000.
No.
He lost manufacturing plants. Ask the auto workers how he lost auto plants.
Ask the auto workers. First of all, the glowing, over the last 4 years, there's been tremendous economic wins. Oh, okay. Thank you for being a journalist there. But I love the two things here. And she did not, Ruhle, of course, did not fact check this at all in any way. However, CNN actually did. So give them some credit for that. The Trump Harris's claim is false. Trump presided over a gain of 414,000 U.S. manufacturing jobs, not a loss of at least 200,000. And the other part of that that even slipped my mind listening to it, because I knew that stat was BS, but she said also that she was handed the worst economy job-wise since the Great Depression. And you think, okay, well, obviously that was COVID. And the fact that she actually pushed back on that, I give her the slightest bit of credit for. It's the most obvious point in the world. But at least she did say that it was COVID. But what I had forgotten was not that, we had obviously massive unemployment based on policies to keep people home from work, to make businesses close, and all the things we've complained about over the years, all of which supported by Kamala Harris, who wanted to extend those policies much, much longer than they actually were implemented. But I had forgotten how much it had bounced back before they actually took office. Now, CNN points it out this way, that it had risen to 14.8% in April 2020, the unemployment rate, which was the highest since 1939. But it had already declined to 6.4% by January 2021, which is when, of course, Harris and Biden took office. 6.4%. I mean, I remember plenty of periods in our history where that was like normal or maybe slightly elevated. 6.4% is pretty much a normal economy. I mean, it's a little bit higher than you'd like it. They say full employment is somewhere between 3% and 4%. But I mean, most of this work was done before they even took office. And I had forgotten how much of that had bounced back before they even took over. Now, Ruhle, I will say, talking about her, who is really kind of the focus of this. I mean, it was a normal Kamala Harris interview. Did Kamala Harris blow up her campaign during this interview? No. Was she good? No. Stephanie Ruhle was just, a serial killer toward the idea of journalism in this interview. She first of all, has a lot of the same hand gestures as Kamala Harris. This whole thing where her hands are moving around, acting out every single individual thing. Your taxes are coming down, but you're saying they're going to go up. It's like this really weird thing that she does and Kamala Harris do. And I don't even want to, it's the only thing I can see sometimes watching Kamala Harris interviews. But the other thing that Harris does in the middle of this is not only the hand gestures, but also saying only about three things. She only can say about three things. She can only remember about three things to say. One of the things she says over and over again in every interview is dreams and aspirations, over and over and over again. Here's some of that shtick.
There are lots of Americans who don't see themselves in your plans. For those who say these policies aren't for me, what do you say to them?
Well, if you are hardworking,
what do you have?
If you
have, what?
The dreams mm-hmm. and the ambitions and the aspirations what I believe you do, you're in my plan. You know, I have to tell you.
So if you have dreams and aspirations, you're in her plan.
Love, and I'm so energized by what I know to be the spirit and character of the American people. We have ambition.
Oh, ambitions.
We have aspirations.
Oh, aspirations.
We have dreams.
We have dreams again. Okay.
We can see what's possible. We have an incredible work ethic. Mm-hmm. But not everyone has the access to the opportunities that allow them to achieve those things. But we don't lack for those things. But not everyone, you know, gets handed stuff on a silver platter. And so my vision for the economy, I call it an opportunity economy, is about making sure that all Americans, wherever they start, wherever they are, have the ability to actually achieve those dreams and those ambitions, which include from middle class families, just being able to know that their hard work allows them to get ahead, right?
I think
we can't and we shouldn't aspire to have an economy that just allows people to get by.
Oh, my God. So dreams and aspirations. She remixed it a little. She used aspire at one point and she used ambitions a couple of times. But she just doesn't have a lot of words in her head. This is a problem for her. You think, well, she's got the word salad thing. Most of that is just repeating the question. She just has like three or four things she remembers. Opportunity economy, dreams and aspirations. There's just not a lot to it. But that's where she goes over and over again. I should point out at this point, and this is important to context. The interview was done in a room with saws and lumber, which I guess is supposed to tell you that she's pro wood. I don't know why she likes hard workers. She connects with union folk. That's what she does. That's why we're in a room with saws and lumber. That's what we do. It's a pathetic, pathetic thing. She's trying to reach out to these groups, though. Now, Rule did answer or ask a question or two about this particular topic in embarrassing fashion, as usual. Here she is.
In 2016, Donald Trump connected with unions. He saw them. There was an emotional connection.
Right, emotional.
But what he didn't do was deliver policy.
Wait, is that your
point?
Last
4 years, we have seen huge wins in this country for
huge
unions. But not all unions have gotten behind you. I want to understand, when the Teamsters decided not to endorse you, what was their reasoning? What are they looking for?
Well, let me go
what
back to our just previous conversation.
Doing?
I'm very proud to have the endorsement of the steelworkers and almost every other major union in America, because I stand by workers and I stand by the
employees. Okay, she stands by workers, whatever. You get the idea. She's just going to blabber again. But, like, listen to the setup to that question. Donald Trump's connection was just emotional, right? Nothing real. And in the last 4 years, we've seen huge wins in this country for unions. We have seen huge wins and they're not getting behind you. What these stupid peasants need? What do they need to support and endorse you? You are perfect. This is not political advice. This is advice to you. You're listening to this podcast. You're watching this particular program. I want you to internalize this, not as far as politics, but as a relationship. Your world of love, find someone. Search and search for someone who looks at you the way Stephanie Ruhle looks at Kamala Harris. The adoration, the love, the belief in everything that you're saying, the childlike trust and understanding. That is what you need in your personal love life. Not going to solve any of our nation's problems, but it'll be great for you, I'm sure. Okay, let's see. That's actually on one of the cards. I wanted to make that point. Rule is basically, at one point after this clip ended, she actually went on to fill in the names of the factories that Kamala didn't know, to help her along with her point that, yes, a couple of factories did close down. But, of course, as we already pointed out, manufacturing was helped during the Trump administration, not hurt. Rule also went many times to sort of pre-nod along, like nodding along with Kamala's answers before she gave them. It's like when you go to your favorite band's concerts and you're sitting there in the crowd and there's a silence and all of a sudden you hear those first three notes of your favorite song and you're like, oh yeah, here it comes. That was Stephanie Ruhle throughout this embarrassing interview. In fact, it was so embarrassing, she actually referred to Kamala Harris as a capitalist.
But as somebody who supports free markets, who's a capitalist, how do you go after price gouging without implementing price controls?
Yeah, how do you do that?
Because once we get in this zone, people start to get worried and they say, I don't know what she stands for.
So just to be very frank, I am never going to apologize for going after companies and corporations that take advantage of the desperation of the American people.
The hell are you
and
talking
as
about?
Attorney General, I saw this happen.
Well, what the hell are you talking about? I mean, first of all, that gives you the real answer, right? She's giving her an out. Hey, you're a capitalist. You love free markets. What are you going to do to avoid price controls? Obviously, this is an out for her to say, look, nothing that I have are price controls. That's crazy. Every economist has, of course, shot the idea down after I gave it. So I better say I'm not in favor of it. She doesn't go that direction. She just says, I'm going to crack down on companies really hard. Now, her dumb example after that clip that she gets to is when I was an attorney general, I saw there was a storm and people charged too much for bottled water or whatever the hell. One of those typical price gouging arguments. I won't get into why that's a dumb argument, but it is. I will say that's how the segment ends. There's no follow-up. There's no follow-up to say, well, wait a minute. Your price gouging proposal had nothing to do with bottled water after a storm. Your price gouging proposal had to do with actually limiting and controlling prices of grocery stores. Kind of a different thing. Can you get into that a little bit? Stop avoiding my questions. None of that. They just go to commercial as if there's no possible way to push back on that. Now, another big story they covered, and I just want you to just to give you the sense of how giddy Kamala Harris was and how easy this interview was by Stephanie Ruhle, who, as I mentioned, like in a sequel to Hostel, mass murdered the idea of journalism during this interview. Here she is asking, she wants to bring up the McDonald's story that apparently Kamala Harris may have worked at McDonald's. She says she does. Other people say she doesn't. Listen to how giddy Kamala Harris is in this exchange.
I just want to ask you yes or no. At any point in your life, have you served two all beef patties, special sauce, lettuce, cheese, pickles, onions
on a sesame seed bun
working at a McDonald's? Yes or no? That's it.
I have.
Okay. Now the other job.
Okay.
Now the other job.
But it was
okay.
Not a
Stop
small job. Like,
did you see how giddy she was? If you are listening on podcast, you're missing not just the smiling and the laughing, but the folded arms and the sitting forward like, this is the greatest moment of my life. Please ask me this question. You're so funny, Stephanie. I love you. Pathetic. Of course, the point of the story, as a former McDonald's employee myself, and you can fact check that one, as a former McDonald's employee myself, the point is, basically, McDonald's is like the lowest level job. I had it. It was my first job. It sucked, okay? I didn't like it all that much, although I did gain about 50 pounds on fries and nuggets. The bottom line of this story, though, is to convince people you are just part of that middle class. You came up, you were just from the salt of the earth. And of course, at the same time, where's Tim Walz? Timmy's over there at Alex Soros's apartment. He's just hanging out over there, which is pretty pathetic. It's just so embarrassing. I want to end with this. Bill Scheer, he's a journalist. He says, amazing how folks who always say Harris should do more interviews find a way to hate every interview she does. And Charles C.W. Cook responds on Twitter, I don't understand this line. The argument is that as a presidential candidate, Harris is obliged to do frequent interviews. It's not contingent upon one liking the results or thinking that she's good at them. And why would it be? And of course, this is a good point, but I go a step further on it. The reason why everybody who's calling for her to do more interviews and doesn't like them is because the only people asking her to do more interviews are her political opponents. No one on her own side, no supporters, no media members, with the possible exception of a couple that we've mentioned, none of those people are asking her to do the normal thing candidates do. That's the problem. That's why you see that. Because no one on her side wants her to do any interviews. They want her to hide from the American people so she can walk into the White House with no resistance. Well, I'm going to keep calling for him. I don't know if it's going to do any good. Hopefully some actual journalist will do it as well. I will leave you with this. At the end of the interview, she repeats the abortion lie about the women in Georgia and North Carolina who actually died from the chemical abortion pills, but they're blaming on the abortion laws. Important for you to go back on Monday's show and watch the fact-checking of that story. I want to go to the pro-life side of the argument here for a second, though. I want to think about not just what's going on in this election, because it's already happening. 2024 is going to happen in 6 weeks, no matter what we do on that case. But what's the long-term freaking plan for pro-lifers after Dobbs? We talk to Ryan T. Anderson next. Don't kid yourself, the future of the Supreme Court is on the ballot. If you think, and we were talking about abortion here in a moment, if you think the Dobbs decision was an important one, something that was really positive for the country, you might say, well, we got the court at least. Well, the radical left doesn't want you to have the court. They want to eliminate the court's conservative majority by packing the Supreme Court with their own handpicked justices so that they get the outcomes that they want. And I guarantee first on the chopping block would be Dobbs. Even President Biden has gotten into the act by making reforming the court one of his final priorities before he leaves office. I don't think he's going to get that done this time, hopefully. But I will say this, that is right around the corner. If Kamala wins, God only knows where we're going from there. We need to have a plan. We're talking about with Ryan Anderson in a second about what is the plan after Dobbs. Well, what's the plan if Kamala wins? First Liberty has a plan. They've looked at this and they've called this assault on the Supreme Court what it is, a Supreme Court coup. This is what they're trying to do. Sound the alarm. They need you to join them. We got to take action together here and have a long-term plan. The Supreme Court cannot be taken over by the left. We've got to do something about this. In the 2024 election, as it approaches, we need to do three things. We need to find out where each of your candidates stand on the radical issues about packing the court, share what you learn with everyone, and do your civic duty and vote. By saying no to the left's Supreme Court coup, we can secure the blessings of liberty and protect the future of our constitutional rights and republic for the children that we have, the grandchildren we're going to have in the future, whatever it is. Go to supremecoup.com/stew. Supremecoup.com/stew. Learn how you can help stop the radical left's takeover of the Supreme Court. Check it out now. Supremecoup.com. Supremecoup.com/stew.
Einsteigen, aufdrehen, losfahren. Mit dem neuen Volkswagen T-Roc bist du bereit für den großen Auftritt. Selbstbewusst und voller Power. Du steigst ein? Keine Kompromisse. Nur du und der Moment. Alles passt. Dein Sound, dein Drive, dein T-Roc. Rockt. Der neue T-Roc.
I'd like to bring in Ryan T. Anderson. He is the president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center, and he has a new piece out in First Things. It's The Way Forward After Dobbs. I'll be sure to tweet out a link to it shortly. Ryan, thanks so much for coming back. I appreciate it.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's a pleasure to be with you.
I'm so glad you were able to make it, and I'm so glad you wrote this, because this strikes me as something that maybe the pro-life movement should have been thinking about long before Dobbs actually was overturned, and maybe didn't spend enough time thinking about that. But you're looking at what to do next, and the piece is really important. If you care about pro-life stuff at all, I can't encourage you enough to go find it and read it. It's a little bit longer of a read, can't fit in a tweet, but take 15 minutes of your time and understand this. Ryan, some of the stuff in here is honestly amazing to me. I talk about this stuff all the time, I didn't even know it. Let me go through some of it if we could. 2010, only 33% of self-identified Democrats thought abortion should be legal under any circumstances. 60% of Democrats believe that today. That is a massive change. There's a lot of growth now for the pro-choice or anti-life movement. What do you make of that? Why is that happening?
Yeah, so and it's not just, you know, Democrats, you know, the statistic you read is Democrats, you know, support for abortion throughout all 9 months of pregnancy. More or less each and every metric that they measure, public opinion over the past decade has shifted in the pro-abortion direction. And I think the biggest cause of this is that now people have real skin in the game, in the sense of it was easier to be, you know, abstractly pro-life so long as Roe v. Wade was on the books, So long as Roe was the precedent of the land, people knew, well, look, I will never be denied an abortion. And I think with the election of Donald Trump, with the appointment of the three conservative justices, and then with the six conservative justices finally overturning Roe, I think that little by little by little led more and more people to realize, oh, wait, I might not be able to exercise my choice. At one point in the piece, I say, you know, it seems like a lot of people are in favor of four exceptions to pro-life laws. The traditional three, rape, incest, and life of the mother, and then a fourth one for my situation, or my daughter's situation, or my girlfriend's situation. And I think that's now why we're seeing some of the ballot initiatives. We've seen all seven in a row now go against us.
Yeah, it really, I mean, that's been stunning. And you're so right on that. I think that's exactly how people think about it. Yeah, you know, I think that's really bad unless I really need it. And you talk about, there are some stunning statistics in your piece, including this one. 4% of babies conceived in marriage will be aborted. That's a terrible stat to me. But 40% of babies conceived out of marriage will be aborted. That is one of the most stunning statistics of all time. With these sorts of figures, it seems like the road is really, really difficult to get people, not just legally, but morally, to accept that this is a horrific practice.
Yeah, and I mean, the reality here is that the best protector of unborn children is marriage. Because marriage attaches the child's father to the child's mother, and then the two of them attached to each other are prepared to be attached to the child. And, you know, as you said, only 4% of the babies conceived inside of marriage will be aborted. And it's almost half. It's 40% of babies conceived outside of marriage. Another statistic that I share in the essay is, you know, that number is who gets aborted. Another statistic is who has an abortion. Of women who have an abortion, only 13% of them are married. 87% of women who have an abortion are unmarried. And again, that just shows you that marriage is what best protects the baby by attaching the child's father to the child's mother. 80% of the women who are having abortions don't have a husband. And that tells us something about what some of the underlying, you know, I say at one point there is an economic dimension to abortion, but it's not primarily the cost of diapers. It's primarily whether or not the mother feels supported in her pregnancy and in raising a child. And the best way you support the mother is by having a father in the picture. And that's going to mean marriage more so than any other public policy that we could promote.
Hmm. You don't just write about all the big problems. It's really mostly about solutions. And I find what you wrote here pretty persuasive. You know, we as conservatives have done a pretty darn good job at making sure the conservative legal experiment is a successful one. I think that, you know, we've moved the ball in a lot of ways pretty well in that realm. But there are a lot of other aspects to this, and too many of them have been ignored.
Yeah, I mean, when you look at the conservative, you know, I'm a full spectrum conservative. And when you look at the conservative ecosystem, we have a lot of institutions that are really, really strong when it comes to originalism and judicial conservatism. We have a lot of institutions that are really strong on economic conservatism. A lot of institutions really strong on foreign policy conservatism. We do not have the same strength when it comes to social conservatism. We have never used the same kind of professionalism and strategy and funding to respond to the sexual revolution that we put into responding to the growth of government, responding to the rise of judicial activism, responding to the blame America first foreign policy school. We haven't done that yet on so-called social issues. It's frequently underfunded. It's frequently understaffed. What we're seeing in the abortion context is that it's national talent and national money going up against state and local talent and money, state by state by state, as we have these abortion ballot initiatives. You know, I just heard from the lady who's running the Arizona ballot, you know, that's on the ballot this November. She said no national funding has come into her state. And so she's battling, there's lots of national money on the pro-abortion side in Arizona. She's doing this just with state and local money, and we're outspent.
Why? Well, I mean, I feel like this is such a fundamental issue. There's a lot of people who really care about, pro-life issues on the conservative cause. That, like, the left seems to have tons of passion to dump national money into these state races. What is the reason that we seemingly don't care as much?
So, I mean, I think there's a lot going on with the funding side. I mean, some of it is that, look, by nature, social conservatives tend to focus on their families, on their churches, on their local communities. They're not as likely to be, you know, multimillionaires or billionaires. If you're successful in business, you might care more about economic policy than you do about social policy, right? So there's a self-interest part of this that you might want to donate to some of the economic conservative groups, you know, lower your taxes, create a better environment for your business, create better environment for trade, whatever the case may be. Whereas on these social issues, protecting unborn babies, there is no personal benefit, right? We have generous benefactors in the pro-life movement, and they gain nothing from their gifts, right? This is not like a you scratch my back, I scratch your back. It's not a quid pro quo. The people who are donating their time and their treasure to the pro-life cause are doing it simply because they believe in it. And that's why you see it's a lot of small dollar donors. It's a lot of volunteers. You know, think about the crisis pregnancy networks. Those are people who are largely just volunteering their time. And those who are paid are underpaid. And those who support it, it tends to be lots of small dollar donors. And so we don't have the elite class with us. And we don't have the billionaire class. We need a couple pro-life billionaires willing to say, I'm going to give my money almost exclusively to the pro-life cause, because other donors can give to some of those other causes, but only I can give to this pro-life cause.
Because I think everything you said is true, and I agree with it. I think that's really common. But there are a lot of people who are very wealthy on the left, and they don't personally get anything out of, I don't know what they get out of it, honestly. But like, there's no personal benefit. It's not a quid pro quo when they're fighting for abortion rights. Why are they doing it on the left and not on the right?
Well, so I think for some people, they do view it as they get something out of it, right? They protect either their freedom or their daughter's freedom or their girlfriend's freedom or their, you know, fill in the blank. But they're viewing this as like, this is protecting my freedom or someone I love's freedom to not be, quote, burdened with an unborn baby, right? Or, you know, you've seen some of the headlines, people saying they'll be punished with an unborn child, right? I think if you have the viewpoint that an unplanned pregnancy is a punishment and therefore you should be free to abort the child, there is almost, I don't want to say quite a quid pro quo, but they do have something to gain from it in a way that it's unclear, you know, what the pro-lifer has to gain by protecting unborn babies, apart from, you know, justice, the common good, virtue, human rights. I mean, but those are all moral values. There's not like a personal cost.
Let me go deeper on the moral values here for a second and go to the churches. You write in your piece, this is shocking, 70% of women who have abortions identify as Christian. More than one third report attending church at least monthly. Of these monthly attendees, just over half said their local churches had no influence over their decision to abort or not. What is the answer here? I mean, do churches just need to be much more vocal about this? This can't stand. I mean, the church is falling apart if that's true.
No, unfortunately, I mean, that study is the research there is, as far as I can tell, quite solid. And it's not just on the question of the church's impact on a woman's decision to have an abortion. I think, you know, maybe a paragraph later, I cite some of the statistics on the virtue of chastity, right? And how many people in the pews have only slept with their spouse. And it's like a fraction of a fraction of a fraction, right? It's I think it's a single digit percentage, if I'm remembering this correctly. And if you think that it's non-marital sex, that's the root cause of the abortion problem, right? You look at the statistics, who gets aborted, who has an abortion, then it's the church's teaching both on the sanctity of life, but then also on the virtue of chastity, on the importance of marriage. And I think on this, the church has largely been AWOL. Besides, like, you know, Respect Life Sunday, one Sunday a week, we might hear something about this. I think it's time for the church to devise both better preaching, but also effective ministries, you know, starting in grade school, starting in middle school, high school, continuing on middle school and high school, to actually transform how people live their lives. Early church was a countercultural church. I think the post-sexual revolution church needs to be more countercultural in how we think through raising the next generation to resist the lies, seductive lies of the sexual revolution.
Last one for you here. We are 6 weeks away from the election. There's been a lot of back and forth about abortion and, you know, what politicians are doing. I feel like the 2024 election, as far as that goes, the messaging is going to be what it is. We can't really change anything about that. But moving past that, one of my main concerns here is if candidates kind of learn they can get pro-life votes by kind of avoiding the issue and taking softer stance because it's more popular in polling, then we come up with a situation where there are neither side is arguing for life. And, you know, my concern, I can understand how it might be beneficial to win an election by maybe avoiding this. It's a tough issue for a lot of people. But we can't, as far as politics go, we have to be encouraging these candidates with our votes, with our donations, to be speaking up about this issue. Because if no one is running in an election that is advocating for this, then there's no one advocating for it.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. I mentioned in the piece that, you know, we face a prospect of the possibility of having a pro-abortion party and then a mildly pro-choice party, especially if you see the down-ticket Republican office seekers, you know, mimicking some of the rhetoric that we've been seeing from the top of the ticket. We should not be asking our elected officials or, you know, our office seekers to go on a suicide mission, right? It doesn't do any of us good to be asking our politicians to say and do things that will just lead them to not being elected. But the flip side of this, right, if that's the rashness vice, the flip side is the cowardice vice. Courage is the mean between those two extremes, right? Rashness on the one hand, going on the suicide mission, but the other hand is cowardice. And I think increasingly that's what we're seeing. We're seeing people who claim to be pro-life or who historically pretended to be pro-life or who are running for a party that historically was pro-life just not rise to the occasion. They're being cowardly in refusing to push back on the lies that are coming from the Democrats. I mean, for the past week and a half now, we've been hearing lie after lie claiming that a young lady died because of Georgia's pro-life laws when really she died because of chemical abortion. Right. And so there's a lot that our political class could be doing. And I know you're doing it. Right. But we need more people, you know, not just in kind of the media class, but the political class to be pushing back on these lies. You know, who has access to get on ABC, NBC, CBS? It's not you and me as much as it is the top of the ticket. And we need those people to be willing to speak boldly and truthfully on these issues.
Well, if you're like me after Dobbs, you probably screamed at your TV a bunch of times. Why wasn't there a plan ready if this actually happened? Ryan is putting together that plan, and it's really, really important. Please read this piece. Ryan T. Anderson, president of the Ethics and Public Policy Center. Be sure to check out the piece. It's on First Things. It's called The Way Forward After Dobbs. You can find a link on my X feed. Ryan, thanks so much for doing this, and I really appreciate you coming on to talk about it.
Yep. Thank you.
Well, it's a miracle, everybody. It has now been 10 full days since an assassination attempt from an ACT Blue donor. Yeah, good job, guys. Really, really good. Now, I will say there have been rumors. There's one guy in Idaho, and there's another Iranian threat on Trump's life. And I don't know, maybe some of the Iranians did contribute to ACT Blue. So I'm not 100% sure on that, but 10 big days. Good job, guys. Also, the PulseCast update for today. This is, of course, not my prediction, but the summary of all the data experts out there. And they have Trump at 44.52% chance to win. Pretty much a toss up here, maybe a slight advantage towards Kamala Harris. But maybe you can, if you kind of squint at the end there, you can kind of see the peak of Harris and see if that one comes down back towards Trump here in the coming days. We'll have, by the way, a new State of the Race podcast on the audio feed. If you go there and you get to the State of the Race, we'll probably update that tomorrow. Some other issues we're following. Putin has issued a nuclear warning to the West over strikes on Russia from Ukraine. Okay. Put that in your internal memory banks. That's a big issue to deal with. Then you have Israel rejecting the U.S.-backed Lebanon ceasefire plan, and it's hitting Beirut again. Okay, so Middle East war, Ukraine war, all this is bubbling inside. We need someone really on top of things to make sure they can make these split-second decisions intelligently. And who we have right now is this guy.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. Welcome to Washington.
Just to point out, he was standing in New York City. Good job, everybody. Diddy has become cellmates with disgraced FTX founder, SBF, Sam Bankman-Fried. Now, they're in the same prison. They're not necessarily cellmates, I don't think, but they are in the same prison. And speaking of Diddy, who's now in prison, you know, some people, and this has been widely reported on, that some celebrities really, really liked his parties. And there's lots of questions going on about them. Anyone who's really at one of these parties and really, really got into it is in a little bit of trouble now. That being said, LeBron James says, "Ain't no party like a Diddy party." Yeah. In resurfaced video amid rap moguls charges. He did say that. He told an emphatic Combs in a video making rounds around social media. And Combs responded, "Yeah, that's what's up." So there you go. I hope all those LeBron James fans out there are open to the idea that, you know, we don't know what happened there, but we'll make sure to watch that one pretty closely. Now I'm just baiting LeBron James fans. Okay, I want you to imagine for a moment that you're about to make the biggest financial decision most people make in their lives, either buying or selling a home. What does it mean to have the best help available? Imagine what it would be like to not only have to worry about whether you're going to have to find the right contractor or the right photographer or the right mortgage company, the right everybody you're going to need. Imagine if that was easy. Imagine if that was something that helped make your experience more profitable. Well, good news, you don't have to imagine that. RealEstateAgentsITrust.com pairs you with the best real estate agent in your area, someone who knows the best practices, someone who understands the crazy housing market, someone who is a team leader and a closer, someone you can trust. If you're thinking about buying or selling a home or both, please get in touch with them. You'll see what I mean. It's RealEstateAgentsITrust.com. Glenn started this company a while ago. The name kind of says it all. RealEstateAgentsITrust.com. It's a free service to you. RealEstateAgentsITrust.com.
Lust auf besonders feine Weihnachten? Erlebe einzigartigen Genuss mit Rewe Feine Welt. Diese Woche zum Beispiel Rewe Feine Welt Schweizer Käse Trüffeltraum mildwürzig, je 150 Gramm Packung nur 3,49 Euro. Oder Rewe Feine Welt italienischer Prosciutto Crudo, roher Schinken mit Meersalz behandelt, mindestens 18 Monate gereift, je 100 Gramm Packung nur 4,29 Euro. Festlich sparen mit Genuss. Rewe, dein Markt.
At youtube.com/studiosamerica, we have this show. We have all the live broadcasts that we do when big news events happen. And don't sleep on the comedy bits. We get a whole comedy bit section. You can kind of scroll down and see that whole playlist, all sorts of stuff about the election and culture and everything else. And we have a new one that came out earlier this week. It features Kamala Harris and her obsession with school buses. You may know all about this, but you may not know that she put out a wonderful compilation CD all about it.
That brought you Farting to the Oldies with Eric Swalwell. It's Now That's What I Call Kamala, Volume 1. Join America's 48th most popular vice president, Kamala Harris, on a musical adventure of discovery as she journeys to the heart of our nation's greatness, the school bus. Who could forget that funky hip-hop classic, Never Too Cool for School? Buses.
Never too cool for school.
School buses.
Buses.
How about that?
Get down with Kamala as she raves about student transportation on the bumpin' club hit, The Future Belongs to Bus.
The future belongs to bus.
The bus has Wi-Fi. Wi-Fi.
Mama's my hero.
Good stuff.
Catch a ride back to the time of your first school-age crush with Yellow Hot Burning Love.
Yellow Hot Burning Love.
Love a school bus.
Buses got me going insane.
Yellow school bus.
Final seats that I dream of.
As the wheels of the bus go round and round, get dizzy with the greatest hits of Kamala Harris.
Here's the thing.
I'll make no sense when I speak.
And brace yourself for an unruly ride with Backseat Anarchy.
Come on, Kamala, Backseat Anarchy.
You need to kick that door down.
Like Willie Brown in the 1990s, climb aboard the Kamala Harris Express and take a musical ride to paradise.
Take a ride to paradise.
The school bus takes us there.
Never touching ground.
Order now and receive the bonus track, Joe Biden is a Racist.
I'm going to now direct this at Vice President Biden.
Joe Biden is a racist.
believe you are a racist. Commit yourself.
Joe Biden is a racist.
Now, that's what I call Kamala Volume 1 is not available in stores. Dial 555-468-5269 or 555-HOT-CAMS to order today. Must be 18 years or older with a valid credit card to order. Please allow 4 to 8 years for delivery. Kamala's notable career achievements not included. Or no.